You are listening to Eastside Radio Podcast.
89.7 FM, Eastside Radio.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships.
Well, you're listening to Beyond the Sea now, and it's Bobby Darin singing to us. And he sang that all the way back in 1959. And I wonder if Bobby Darin had any idea that the sea of which he sang in that particular song would change so much over time. Although I suspect he didn't get too much to think about it, really. He did die in 1973 at age just 37 in the recovery room after open-heart surgery. Anyway, getting back to the sea, each week on this program, I mention as a bit of a context information the water temperature down here at Bondi Beach, and today it's 19.2 degrees. And by my recollection, that would seem to be warmer than last year. So out of interest, I thought what I'd do is just dig up some of the September average water temperatures for the last few years here at Bondi. Interestingly, I discovered that over the years 2020 to this year, those averages were 17.3, 17.5, 17.5, 17.8, 17.9 and 18.6. Now, on no occasion did it go backwards during that time, and I suspect that it's indicative of all waters in the region and not just that at Bondi Beach. I wondered if it might be part of what people call global warming, and if so, what are some of the consequences of it? But rather than me do that research, I thought what I'd do is speak with someone who already has done the work and who is far more qualified than I am to talk about it. And that person is Professor Matthew England, an Australian physical oceanographer and a climate scientist and Professor of Oceanography at the Centre for Marine Science and Innovation at the University of New South Wales. He joins me now. Professor England, welcome to Monday Drive.
Thanks, Alan. Good to be here.
Have you had a swim today?
I have. I actually had two because it's a public holiday, so I managed to go down only half an hour ago. But the interesting thing is we've had a nor'easterly or northerly wind for a few days, and that actually often leads to a cooling down of the temperatures. And certainly today was colder in the water than yesterday. So it's important to remember that these weather variations can give us warming and cooling. But as your introduction flagged, we have seen an overall warming trend year by year for the most part. Occasionally there'll be a dip down, but over the last 50 years, oceans have been warming globally, and certainly the Tasman Sea is a hot spot of warming. I can talk more about that during the show.
Yeah, look, when I was a kid, and that's quite a long time ago, I should add, when I was a kid, I thought that the sun had something to do with warming things up.
It definitely does.
Well, what's all this business about climate change versus the sun heating up the water?
Yeah, I mean, we have warmer temperatures in the ocean during summer. We have... if the winds are steady enough, we'll get a warmer daytime temperature than at nighttime. So the sun definitely heats the planet. What greenhouse gases do, though, is they trap that heat, which is fantastic. We need greenhouse gases in our atmosphere to keep the planet habitable. Without them, this planet would not support life. So we've got a lovely atmosphere with greenhouse gases in it. Unfortunately, over the last couple of hundred years, where we've really dramatically increased the baseline. We were the number was 280 parts per million for carbon dioxide, and we're now, well on our way to 450 and beyond. I mean, the emissions increases are ongoing and heading us into uncharted territory, at least for the last million years or so.
Okay, so you've mentioned greenhouse gases, you've mentioned the sun. I forbid the use of the word Niño, Niña, or oscillation in this conversation, because I don't understand what any of them mean. But can you tell us, therefore, why things are getting warmer, apart from those two factors you've just mentioned?
Yeah, no, I mean, so I should say the solar cycle, and we've got solar scientists quantifying this very precisely for us. The solar cycle does vary from decade to decade, year to year. There are like 11-year oscillation and so on. But that solar cycle and variations in solar energy I cannot account for the last 50 years of warming. The only thing that we know can account for that is the greenhouse gas increases. And it's that increase of those gases in the atmosphere that basically trap extra heat. And the nice thing about the measuring systems we have in place, so we've got balloons in the atmosphere, we've got floats in the ocean, we've got global satellite measurements, ships that trek around the ocean are making top to bottom measurements of the ocean temperature. And so we can actually put together what's called a heat budget of that heat we've trapped. And so we know very precisely how much the greenhouse gases have increased by. We can measure their concentration in the atmosphere. And so we can go looking, where is that energy located? Hmm. And it turns out that 90% of the energy that we've trapped in the climate system is in the ocean. And what I mean by that is that the actual amount of warming we've had over the last 50 years in the ocean is 90% of the extra energy in the system. Only it's going to surprise listeners to hear this metric. Only 2% can be found in the atmosphere, and that's because the atmosphere doesn't hold much heat. It's just basically a gas, and so the atmosphere has warmed significantly at the surface, but there's only about 2% of that extra energy in the atmosphere. And then the remaining 2% is found on the land surface warming, and then about 6% has gone into melting ice, the ice caps around Greenland and Antarctica. So this energy budget tells us that the oceans are doing a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of absorbing this extra energy.
Yeah, you've just mentioned the ice caps, which you said are melting. But by my logic, if the ice caps are melting, that's putting cold water into the oceans, and they should be getting colder, not warmer. Where's my...
it's a good question. And the actual... it doesn't just put cold water in, it puts fresh water in. The oceans are salty, and so the seawater we have in our oceans has a certain salt content to it. By melting the ice caps around Greenland and Antarctica, we're adding fresh water. It's very cold, but it dilutes the amount of saltiness. And that's some, you may have heard of the slowdown of the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. We've got a similar circulation off Antarctica. That freshening is way more important than the cooling effect there, because the density of the water at the polar latitudes is very much set by the saltiness. And so we're seeing a slowdown of those overturning circulations. So you're right, that's another change in our system. It adds some cooler water. It's also fresh. The coldness it definitely changes the ocean temperatures, but it's a very small effect compared to that 90% of heat uptake that I mentioned.
I can see there should have been some more technical terms I added onto the banned list.
Yeah, sorry about that.
we kind of enjoy the warming weather in terms of your early morning swim this morning, or both of them, but there have got to be some ecological effects that rising water temperatures have on sea life. As opposed to humans enjoying the surf life. What are some of those adverse effects on marine flora and fish and things?
Yeah, no, we're seeing a sort of poleward migration of fish species. So I've swum off Sydney and seen exotic fish that are really tropical fish that you normally don't see south of maybe the Queensland border. So there's certainly a spreading southward in our hemisphere of the tropical species, because they're basically the range of temperatures they enjoy is spreading further south. So we're definitely seeing impacts on fisheries. We also up north, we're seeing some devastating impacts on our coral reef. So fish can generally migrate away from, if the waters get too warm, they'll tend to migrate away from those temperatures. But they can still impact, if they've got certain feeding areas that disrupts their life cycles for sure. But one of the most concerning ecosystems that we're seeing change at the moment are the coral reef systems globally. I mean, not just the Barrier Reef, also across at Ningaloo and over in the Caribbean. I mean, unfortunately, the coral reef experts I speak to see this as a trajectory that is possibly past the point of no return. And what they mean when they say that is that the warming progression we're on will see these mass bleaching events recur more frequently, to the point that we'll lose our reef systems globally over time. There'll be some pockets that remain resilient, and so that's one of the things we want to see for the reef systems around Australia, is to understand where it's resilient and put in our efforts to protect those areas. But unfortunately, you can't protect, you know, if the ocean temperatures keep on rising, they go past very critical thresholds for corals.
Yeah.
And that really has a big impact.
I think it was Malcolm Turnbull, when he was Prime Minister, threw a heap of money at the Gold Coast, not the Gold Coast, the Great Barrier Reef, and he was criticised for doing it. Is it possible that money thrown at it can mitigate what you've just explained as something which is fairly grubby and terminal?
Absolutely. Look, it's a really important thing to talk about, because unfortunately money can do go some way. It can sort of give us, say, a strategy for understanding which bits of the reef we should protect the most. You know, where should we, for example, there's a crown of thorn starfish up there. So if you go and start pulling those off the reef system, you should go focus on those areas that are more resilient to ocean change. But all the projects I've seen to create coral in the lab, I mean, you cannot create a coral ecosystem with a few, you know, by putting a metal grid down on a rock and planting some coral polyps. It's a very complex system that nobody's been able to really replicate.
So what do you do with the money that somebody like Turnbull threw at it?
Well, I mean, I think there are measures to understand the ocean circulation and the regions that are most threatened by global warming. There's, you know, remediation efforts to get rid of crown of thorn starfish, to make sure, for example, the fertilizer that's used, a lot of sugarcane industries up there use a lot of fertilizer. And 30, 40 years ago, that was the biggest threat to the reef, was the runoff of this nutrient-rich water that was messing up the balance of seawater chemistry there. Mm. And the reef was suffering back then from fertilizer. So in a way, the money can be used. I'm not saying that's a complete waste of investment, but the biggest thing we can do to stop the bleaching of corals is to get off carbon production of energy. Mm. Coal, gas, all those dirty forms of producing energy should make way for these fantastic new technologies. Solar for Australia, we can absolutely deliver our energy load with solar plus battery storage. Mm. A bit of wind energy would help as well. But we've a PhD student at the University of New South Wales did a study on this and showed that our path to net zero is a very straightforward one for Australia, because we've got vast amounts of land that can tap into that solar resource. Even where coal-fired power stations are at the moment, those companies can actually set up a solar grid there at that same location and use the infrastructure they've built to take the energy from a coal-fired power station. You take the energy from a farm of solar panels. Farmers can cash in on this. I mean, there's a lot of business growth that can come from this transition, and we just need to leap forward with that.
Look, I don't want to put you in a difficult position, but do you disagree absolutely with Donald Trump on everything he's had to say about global warming?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy stuff, and it sort of goes against high school geography. Anybody who, you know, like, it's just our school kids learn about the basics of our Earth system, our climate system, and greenhouse gases are actually, and the discovery that greenhouse gases trap heat and keep our planet warm was made over almost 200 years ago. Eunice Foote and Sir John Tyndall did the experiments, showed these greenhouse gases trap heat in the atmosphere, did the first calculations of that radiation balance. So it's multi-century old science. It is akin to saying the Earth's flat to say that greenhouse gases aren't fundamental to how our climate behaves, just like volcano eruptions are, just like solar. You know, it's part of the mix. And of everything that controls our climate, you know, the configuration where our continents are and the solar cycle, all these things I've mentioned, it's only the greenhouse gases that we're changing in a fundamental way right now. Everything else is pretty much, we can't really change where volcanic eruptions occur, how the solar energy varies. All these things are sort of set. They vary a bit, but it's the greenhouse gases that we're clobbering at the moment. Mm. And his narrative about this is it's laughable if it wasn't, you know, if he wasn't one of the most powerful people on the planet, certainly in terms of future carbon policy globally. You know, the US was going to lead the way alongside lots of other nations a couple of years ago, and now they're in the backwater, unfortunately.
I'm speaking with Professor Matthew England from the Centre for Marine Science and Innovation at the University of New South Wales. Matthew, you've been the very worthy recipient of various grant funding over the years to assess the risk of ocean warming. Are you satisfied that your assessments have been taken seriously and that there have been mitigation strategies as a result?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I think the Australian government, you know, recognises this is a problem, and generally both sides of politics do. It's still a bit of disquiet in the coalition, I know, about whether they embrace net zero, but for a while there they did. So we're seeing progression of policy around reducing emissions. Unfortunately, it seems that the policy doesn't translate into the action that's needed. And what I mean by that is we're still seeing, you know, big extensions on gas-fired plants over in WA. Mm. We're seeing new fossil fuel extraction projects open up. And it's all very well saying Australia will reduce our emissions, but if we're exporting, you know, five times that amount around the world for others to burn, it's still going to change our climate. So, and then globally, it's been a bit of a dog's breakfast. We've got some nations really ramping up, getting away from burning carbon to make energy and fuel power. Other nations are going gangbusters with, you know, extracting coal and gas and oil and so on. So it's been a mixed bag. We certainly haven't seen the action. I was a PhD student in the very late 80s, early 90s. And even back then, we had the first IPCC reports coming out saying we've got to act now. Mm. And so, you know, 35 years later, the action does not match the science advice. You know, imagine if COVID was just treated with dismissal a couple of years back and, it's not really a problem. I know some people said that, but we saw the science as...
I think Mr. Trump was one of those, wasn't he?
Exactly, yeah. So it's funny, there's a strong correlation between people who denied COVID was a problem and those that deny climate change is a problem. There's a sort of gung-ho attitude in some people's minds that these things aren't an issue. But certainly, I mean, scientists and engineers can solve this problem, and we just need to give industry and business the impetus to get in behind those projects. Every time we look at development of new technologies, who would have thought a smartphone would be in virtually everybody's hands? Mm. And the devices that make up a smartphone today, I think you'd need, you know, a modern house to have all the instrumentation that goes into a smartphone today. You need, you know, the GPS systems and so on. You need basically multiple rooms of a building to house that instrumentation 30, 40 years ago. Now we have such advances in technology. And the same thing with these carbon, you know, renewable energy systems. We actually can grow innovation. And we already can make solar energy really well, but we can do even better with battery storage if that sort of impetus was there for industry to get behind the development of those technologies.
Oh God, you're throwing me between Trump and Musk.
Yeah, that's true. There's another weird character out there who seemed to, generate an industry to address climate change and then got into bed, figuratively speaking, with a guy who denied it was an issue. So,
extraordinary.
Yeah, very strange.
Look, rather than concentrate on the big people and governments and presidents and things like that, is there anything that we, local councils or organisations around Bondi, can be paying attention to or indeed things that we can be doing in order to mitigate or adapt or avoid that disaster scenario you pointed out earlier?
Yeah, there are things we can do individually. Most people's power bills will be less. It's difficult when you're in apartment buildings and so on, but there is even for apartments that, you know, if you're renting, you know, to get onto the building to get solar panels on the building, and it's got to be agreed across the apartment owners.
There are only 3% of apartment buildings have solar.
Yeah, and this is a big, I mean, for people living in a house, they can get the benefits almost immediately. The power bills come right down and they can repay the costs within only a couple of years. 20 years ago, it took a long time to repay from the investment made. So yeah, I mean, going to solar, obviously voting the right way and keeping your local member aware of the concerns you have, because we are seeing these extreme events. They're very costly. Their insurance premiums are going up. So it's these little things that individuals can do help. Unfortunately, it does need that sort of business industry driven change that will be triggered by the right government policies. And that's why it's been disappointing to see the inaction, because the way it's worked out is the business sector has jumped on renewables when a government's come in with the incentives for that, and then a new government will come along. We're seeing that in the US disincentivize that transition. and those businesses are left out to, you know, they're basically going to potentially collapse. And that's just disastrous for innovation. You want a sense of certainty. And that's, I think that's the biggest thing that's held us the solution back, is that the business sector has been given mixed messages. Yes, it's the biggest problem we're facing, to no, this is a hoax. So it's really not been the right messaging for them to act with the resolve that they could.
Professor Matthew England from the Centre of Marine Science and Innovation at University of New South Wales, thank you so much for joining us here on Monday Drive.
Thanks so much, Alan.
If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sail.
89.7 FM, Eastside Radio.
You have been listening to Eastside Radio Podcast. For selections of more enjoyable content like this, visit our website, eastsidefm.org, and click on Podcast.